Hey, good morning. We'll be starting momentarily. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you?
Hey, Doug. How are you? How's everything going there?
Oh, pretty good. Thank you.
Hey, getting back to the swing of things.
I'm trying to. I was on the road all last week, and so just got back Friday evening, and it's nice to be home.
Wow. All right, now you had a...
Life with you.
What's that?
Of life with you.
All right, thank God. Thank God. Life is good when you have interests and things that keep your attention. And you enjoy what you do work-wise. So you see, if you have a few things, they can, you know, really go a long way.
I would agree.
Any questions or come up in the past, and any type of questions you have before we start? Maybe some things you have on your mind?
You know, I have two that are sun-raised. If I can grab them, just take me a second.
Sure, go ahead.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning, Cal. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Been a busy week without Doug here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I take care of two houses and two yards and his mom.
That's true. How's she doing? Your mother-in-law?
She's doing really well.
Okay, good.
I'm kind of surprised by that, and it's, I guess it's a good thing.
Yeah, for sure.
That's when dementia helps in your favor.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Okay. Oh yeah, you'll be familiar with this. So, the two questions are unrelated. In the story of Joseph, when he goes to meet his brothers, and they strip off his coat, and then they throw him into the well or the pit, and it says the well was empty and there was no water in it. So we've discussed before that that's, if I recall, there's something to be understood from the fact that those two statements are right next to each other because one seems to be redundant.
That's right.
Well was empty, there was no water in it, and I think the sages derived that there were no scorpions or life-threatening insects in that.
The opposite, that there were scorpions and snakes in there.
I'm sorry, okay.
Yeah, they say that.
And so Daniel raised the question. He said, why doesn't the Torah just say that? Why put a veiled reference in there? Why not just be open and direct?
Well, that's a question on the entire Torah. I mean, the whole method of the Torah is to engage man into the area of thought, and if you just give him clearly cut statements that have no question on them, so thought is not engaged. You just read it, you comprehend it. But you don't get pushed into an area of questioning and thought that will bring you to even new, you know, more, you know, worlds of ideas. Again, there's a limited amount that can be written down. When you have a discreetly sized book, so that means there's only X amount of pages and X amount of text. So if we only just write, you know, cut and clear statements, so as soon as you finish the book, you're done. There's no further you can go, and that's the case with a man-made book, because man's knowledge is finite. But when you're talking about God's wisdom, that it should be something which any human being, billions of human beings, can see great insights to, and all the different billions of areas that each individual ponders. So God created the book in a way where there are questions on every single verse. And those questions prod our thinking and allow us to enter into the non-physical world of thought. And when we're in that world of thought, when we're sitting there with a physical book in front of us, but we've got a question, and we start thinking about the question. So then we start seeing one question, we see another answer, but that answer might bring a question to another area. And it just engages us in thinking and deriving greater and greater truths. I mean, was it Newton that had invented calculus? I mean, that's not something, you don't see calculus in the world. What you see are certain physical objects. Man can extrapolate, he can create an initial system of math, but then they start seeing that there's so much more there. And look what he was able to uncover just from certain questions that he had, just based on looking at the physical world. So the physical world is designed just like the Torah, that you see certain things physically, and you can just look at the view, or you can start asking questions. What's the difference between the leaves on this tree and that tree? Why do these trees grow this high? These trees only grow this short? And then you start comparing, and you start deriving rules based on the inconsistencies. So that's why, to answer Daniel's question, you have inconsistencies in order to push you into an area where you can uncover vast more knowledge than just the pen and ink can offer.
That makes sense. Okay.
It is, that's the whole purpose, because the world of thought, you can just soar, and it's not limited by the number of words that you have. God wrote the Torah in such an amazing way that it does this exact thing. It engages our thought, and we think into it, and we start seeing more and more areas of truth. I mean, the one example comes to mind, you know, related to this event. I think we may have discussed it, but it was on this past week's Parsha. I guess we can take it. There's a couple of things that come to mind now, but I guess it's related to yours with Joseph. So, you know, how did Joseph become able to... He became such a wise psychologist. He was able to understand the dreams of Paro. It doesn't say there that, you know, God gave him any insight. It just says that he told Paro the dreams, and Paro liked his interpretations of the seven cows and the 7 years. I mean, so he said that you can have 7 years of famine and 7 years of plenty. I mean, reverse order, of course. So Paro's astrologers also said the dreams, well, you can have seven daughters and you're going to bury seven daughters. So it was so much more appealing, the Paro and Joseph's interpretation. So the Torah doesn't tell us this. It just shows us, for some reason, that Paro jumps onto to Joseph's interpretation and loves it, but he doesn't love the astrologer's interpretation. But then we have to ask, well, where did Joseph get this insight from? How did he become such a smart dream interpreter? And then we look back and we see that not too long before this, I don't know, a few weeks maybe, or a few days, it was a little bit before this, right. Well, he interpreted the baker and the wine store's dreams. And 17 years before that, or some odd years before that, even longer probably, he was seeing his own dreams about the stars bowing down to him, the stalks of wheat bowing down to him. So again, he had dreams. There are three clear incidents of Joseph in dreams. But the Torah doesn't tell us much more about that. But we're left with the questions, why did Paro like his interpretations anymore? And where did Joseph become such a wise individual? And the whole story of the Jews getting down to Egypt was all because of Joseph. But if you think about it, you start seeing that God did a tremendously wise act when he gave Joseph the two dreams of the wheat bowing down to him and the stars and the moon and the sun bowing down to him. Because those very dreams are what elicited the jealousy of the brothers. And because of their jealousy, they sold them. But it was also because of those dreams that Yosef had to have started pondering what were these ideas behind the dreams, because he became such a wise dream interpreter. But you see that there was a pattern to the dreams. Each time there were dreams, there were always two. He had two, the wine... Stuart and the baker, there were two dreams there, and Paro had two dreams. See, if Yosef didn't have the initial, encounter with dreams being in a duplicate manner, he never would have been able to determine that Paro's dreams were prophetic. And that's why Paro liked his dreams more than everybody else's, because Joseph showed Paro, and he said to Paro the words, you see, that what God has shown is going to do. He has shown to Paro. He says the dreams of Paro are one. And he repeats that. That's the first words out of Joseph's mouth when Paro tells him the dreams. And he repeats it. So if that's the first words out of Joseph's mouth, he is trying to point Paro towards the most significant nature of the dream. And he's successful. Joseph shows Paro not an amazing interpretation, but he says something different from all the other astrologers. He said, your dream design is different than a typical dream. Typically, you don't have duplicate dreams like this. And Paro agreed. And Ibn Ezra says this. He says that this is actually a statement of Ibn Ezra, that duplication in dreams shows it's prophetic. And that's what Joseph realized. The brothers had become jealous and sold them. They didn't see this idea, but Joseph pondered these dreams. It even says that his father watched the matter. When the brothers said, are you going to really rule over us and all? So they attacked him. But it says in the verses that Jacob watched the matter. That means Jacob knew something about dreams too. Joseph's father knew that this type of duplication is indicative of a prophetic source. So the very thing which caused Joseph to be sold, the jealousy of the brothers, that was a response to the double dreams, those two dreams not only brought Joseph down to Egypt, and he became the harbinger to the release of the Jews, but those two dreams also gave him the training by which he can bring the brothers down and be successful with Paro and get into the position of power by interpreting the dreams. So with one very clever move that achieved the descent of Joseph for the sake of bringing the Jews down and eventually creating them to the people. So you see, it was very, very clever that the two dreams elicited the response that God wanted. The brothers had free will, but God knew that they would not respond properly. Nonetheless, he gives people free will. He says, here you have a choice whether to sell Joseph or not. He knew what they would do. It was all for the good. And, of course, they are responsible for selling him. It was a sin, but they repented. But that actually gave Joseph the opportunity while in prison all those years to ponder the whole psychology of dreams, until he reached the point where he identified elements that proved something is prophetic and what is not prophetic. And there again, all the Torah tells you is he had dreams, and that's it. It doesn't really give you all the other information, but if you think into it, then it starts becoming an amazing discovery. And that type of discovery process is what God wants in terms of giving a person the greatest amount of enjoyment. Because when you have the question, you look into it, and then all of a sudden you see the wisdom behind it, then that, wow, that's an amazing insight. Now imagine if all this was just written out, very nice, but you didn't have the chance to think about it yourself, so you forfeited the opportunity for critical thinking and to derive new ideas. But when you do look into it, and you see this, so it's just an amazing thing, it's enjoyable, and it allows you to enter new worlds of ideas that you just can't write down every single idea, it's just too many. So how does God allow those worlds of ideas to be open to us? By hinting to them with these inconsistencies. But then what it also shows you, finally, is that the next time you open the Chumash, or the Torah, and read it, you've just become convinced of how deep this Torah is, and you're not going to be satisfied with simplistic answers the next time around, because you've had a taste of how far you can go with the design of the Torah.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Does that mean then that you shouldn't be so hung up with whether you get the right way or the wrong way, but it's sort of engaging you in the methodology of thinking and your thinking evolves?
Yes, and there could be many right ways. I mean, there could be many true answers on one verse, as long as they're not in contradiction.
Right.
But yeah, that's a very good point you're making, Cal. I mean, we shouldn't be concerned. That's more of an egotistical thing. Do I have the right answer or not? That's not the concern. The concern, I mean, you definitely want to see truth. But it's not because you want to be personally right. You want to make sure that you're following a certain method. And the more a person studies, the more their method is sharpened.
This is really helpful, Rabbi. Thank you.
Sure. You tell me what Daniel thinks of the answer.
Yeah, I think he'll like the answer.
Good.
I think he will. Okay. Second of two questions?
Sure, go ahead.
So, it's apparently said that the Torah existed before the world.
Okay.
And if the Torah... So his question was, how could the Torah exist before the world if the Torah is based on free will decisions, if you will, of the patriarchs?
Right. It means that the... Well, the... There's a statement in the Talmud that says, Histachel Baraisa Bara Alma, which in Aramaic means that God looked at the Torah and then he created the world. So, but the Talmud also states that the Torah did not exist. Abraham didn't have the Torah. So how do we make sense of the two statements? That on the one hand, it says that God looked at the Torah and created the world. And on the other hand, the Talmud openly states, I mean, it's not the Talmud, the Torah tells you that Torah was not given until Sinai. Yeah, there were a few commands up to that point. So what we can say, though, is that the same way that Abraham was able to extricate himself from idolatry by using his intelligence, and he perceived truths. So that means those truths are what the Torah is, the fundamentals of the Torah, not necessarily the specifics about tzitzis and tefillin and Passover, different things, but the... These laws all do trace themselves back to fundamental truths that you can identify with your intelligence, even without a Torah. And Abraham was able to do that. The existence of one creator and the relationship of man being subservient to that creator. The equality that we should express towards every other human being, because received by... By definition, the Creator's will is that there's not just one individual, but there's many individuals alive. It must be that he has an equal will for all. That's why they're all here. So therefore, there has to be a certain amount of equality in our how we treat others. So when it says that God looked at the Torah and created the world, that idea means that the Earth's creation is for the objective of the Torah fundamentals. That man is really the primary creation, and all else, the rabbis say, is really just to serve man in his objective of, you know, reaching God, studying, enjoying the world of wisdom. And this, you know, as we call the earth, is just the vestibule before the final banquet hall. The final banquet hall means the next world. This is just our initial existence, which is very temporary. Until we pass away and we finally reach the real existence, where we're not impeded by the limit of the five senses. We won't have that limitation anymore in terms of obtaining new knowledge. Our souls will be free from that limitation. Rabbi Chait mentioned one also that the majority of the Torah that we learned is in the next world. But there has to be an attachment to the Torah. So that's, of course, what our objective is here. So, yes, the patriarchs all had free will like every human being does. So the specifics about their actions, of course, were not written down yet. That would imply there was no free will, that they were puppets. But there was no given Torah. That wasn't until Sinai. But when it says that God looked at the Torah and created the world, it means that the fundamentals of Torah, God knew what they were long before he gave the Torah. I mean, God knows the future. And that's a question which Maimonides takes up too. He says, if God knows the future in general, how does man have free will? So Maimonides there explains that his knowledge is not the knowledge of causes. If it was, then you would be right. If God had knowledge based on causality, that means all the causes were in play for what I'm going to do today, so I have no free will. Everything I do is based on causes, so I'm trapped. I would be just like a leaf on a tree. The leaf on the tree is based on causes, yes. All the different trees that came before it, until this tree's seed fell to the ground and it grew 60 years ago, and now this leaf is there due to the moisture and the weather patterns and so on. Yes, everything in nature is causality, but free will is not. How does God know it? It's not through causality. It's a different area, and it does not impede free will. So, two very good questions.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting how the... what I wanted to mention was, like, on this past week's Parsha of Tetzava, so Jesse Fishbein had a question a couple of years ago. And if you look at these two past Parshas that we read in the Torah, of Truma and Tetzava, so Truma starts out by discussing the vessels and the tabernacle, the mobile temple. And it talks about the ark, of course, which is the focus of the temple, because that housed the two sapphire stones that had the Ten Commandments on them. And it also talks about the table with the showbread, and it talks about the menorah. But the last vessel, the incense altar, is not mentioned in last week's Parsha. It's not mentioned until the very end of this week's Parsha. That means for some reason it's protracted in terms of the Torah's record of its description and its laws. And Jesse was wondering, why is that? I mean, it's in the same exact room as the menorah, the candelabra, and the table with the showbread. The incense altar was the third and last vessel that was in that room. Why is that not talked about in the same exact area in the Torah? It's odd. Furthermore, whenever it talks about lighting the menorah, I'll read to you the verse. It's Exodus 30. Verses 7 and 8. And it says there that, quote, "And on it," meaning the incense altar, "Aaron shall fumigate the spice incense every morning when he cleans the lights. He shall incense that altar. And when Aaron lights the lights in the evening, he shall again incense it." He shall light up again incenses, "a regular incense before God for your generations." So it's very interesting that when it talks about the activity of the incense altar, it's in connection both times with the candelabra. Again, it says, quote, and this again is Exodus 30, verses 7 and 8. And it says, quote, "And on the incense altar, Aaron will fumigate a spice incense every morning when he cleans the lights of the candelabra. And when Aaron lights the lights in the evening, he shall incense on that altar again." So you see how the incense is tied up with the menorah. Not only that, the Talmud states that when the menorah would be cleaned out from the wicks and the previous burning, so what he would do is that the priest would clean the wicks and ashes from five of the seven bowls on top of the menorah. Then they would interrupt the cleaning with the lighting of the incense, and then return and clean the remaining two bowls that were left on the menorah. So you have a third case where menorah and the incense are bound up together. So you have two questions. What's this relationship between the incense altar and the menorah? And also, why is the incense placed all the way at the end? It's not together when it's discussing all the other vessels. So here, again, you have another example of Daniel's first question about... Why don't you just tell me the answer? But the Torah just seems to be hinting to you something. Whenever you clean the menorah, you got to light the incense. Whenever you light the menorah, you got to light the incense. And what was the incense? It smoked up. It created a cloud. So, what I wanted to say on this is that the idea of the menorah, the Torah talks about kiner mitzvah and Torah or, that the Torah, a single mitzvah is like a single candle, but the entire Torah is light. So that's a statement that means to say that a individual mitzvah is a good thing, but it's only somewhat illuminating, like a single candle. It only illuminates your life somewhat, but it's not a perfected life if you just have one mitzvah. When you have the entire system, Torah, then you have or, then you have light. For a candle is equated to mitzvah, but Torah is equated to light. So you see that Nair is equated with Torah, is always equated with light, something illuminating. But in terms of the knowledge that we have about Torah, about God, it's limited. It's severely crippled. It's true what we can attain, but it's nothing. It's like a drop of water in all the oceans of the world. And the way we express this is, for example, like when the high priest, he went into the Holy of Holies on one day of the year. And the danger when he went into the Holy of Holies, which is where the Torah, the Ten Commandments were contained in the Ark, is that the person might think, the priest, even the high priest, might think, I'm getting closer now to the ideas of God. There's a great danger in that. I mean, God had once killed 57,000 people because they looked inside the Ark when it was returned from the Philistines. So why were they killed? They were killed because they thought there was something tangible in connection with God. We can see something about God. For the very same reason, God tells Moses at Mount Sinai to rope off the mountain. Don't let anybody go on the mountain, for anybody who touches the mountain will be killed. Why such a severe thing just for touching the mountain? Because the people who would go onto the mountain to ascend also harbored a thought that there's something in terms of location regarding God. If I go on the mountain, maybe I'll see something in connection with God. But that's idolatry. That's heretical. God is not physical in any way. And if we have an idea that God is physical, so then our lives are useless. They're worthless. We have a completely erroneous, false idea what God is. So God warns Moses about that. Then you see that he killed people that did express that. And also there's that danger with the high priest. So when he goes into the Holy of Holies to do the worship on Yom Kippur, what he has to do in there is to smoke up the whole room and create a veil between himself and the Ark. Not that God is in the Ark, of course, but the veil, it has to be something which now reminds him that there's a veil between us and God. And that's why cloud was necessary in the temple. That was what the purpose of the incense altar was. But it was only accidental, subordinate to the menorah, because the menorah really indicates the God who created the world in 7 days. And this is who we have to remind ourselves, who we are approaching here in temple. That's why when we start praying every morning, the first thing we say is, the first blessing is, blessed is the one who spoke and the world came into being. The first thing we want to say in the morning when we pray is to remind ourselves of the nature of this God, meaning we have to make sure we are clear that our concept of God is creator of the universe. And that's synonymous with the 6 days of creation and the seventh day that he rested. So in as much as we come close to God in terms of the knowledge of God, and that's reminded by the menorah, the 7 days of creation and light, which is considered, Torah is considered light. Light is equated to illumination, to knowledge. We also have to offset that by the fact that we don't know what God is. So that's what the cloud represents. That explains why whenever they lit the menorah, it had to be accompanied with cloud. Yes, the menorah is to remind us of concept of the creator, but that has to be accompanied with the fact that we are blinded by the smoke of the incense. That's why when they lit the menorah in the evening, they would have to light the incense altar to create a cloud. And when they cleaned, even cleaning the menorah, any activity with the menorah had to be accompanied by the cloud that was created by the incense. But since it's really subordinate to the menorah, so therefore this whole altar comes at the very end. It's not really a positive it's not delivering a positive concept in as much as it's trying to negate certain ideas that we might have. So since it's a negating, it's a vessel which is to negate wrong ideas, it doesn't have the same description. It's not in the same area. When we talk about the showbread that God can supply for all the 12 tribes, that's why there were 12 loaves of bread. So it's showing that God is all-powerful. And the menorah tells us, defines that God that God we relate to is the one that created the world. That's another positive idea. So those are positive ideas, but the incense altar is to remind us that, but don't think the knowledge that you have of God is that you have any knowledge of God per se. You have knowledge about what God created, but you don't have knowledge of God. So it comes to negate, and that's what cloud is. It actually says, Maimonides talks about it, in Book 3, Chapter 9, in the Guide. And he talks about how there was always cloud associated with temple, and Even Sinai. Sinai was a cloudy and rainy day, he says. Again, to teach that idea. And you see, too, that cloud was with the Jews from the time that they left Egypt, the pillar of cloud. So you see that there's a theme going on over here. So, again, going back to what we were talking about initially, that the Torah is, the knowledge of God is just infinite. We can't even, you know, besides God himself, that we can't know what he is, but the Torah itself is just a great amount that is almost beyond our grasp. So, similar to that first question that Daniel had, where it's tied to this concept that we could only learn things by way of indication, since the knowledge itself is so immense, it just can't be committed to writing. It's just impossible. You'd be writing for a billion years, and you wouldn't be making a scratch in the surface of all the knowledge out there. So the Torah's method is to just be writing in a very cryptic manner, but just enough to reveal the questions and the answers. But then you have to use your intelligence to derive them. And this idea about the author also teaches us another aspect of this, that the source of this knowledge we can never know. There's a veil between man and God. And you read that chapter, Book 3, Chapter 9, and Maimonides got perplexed. And he goes into this, and this is it's so important that it deserves its own chapter. Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi. That's very helpful.
Rabbi, that kind of leads me into another question then about the land of Israel. There seems to be kind of a specialness or something that God gave the land to the Jews. Does that, I guess I don't really know how to think about that. There's a couple questions there. One of them is, why would he give land to the Jews that's already inhabited by other people, other than to show them that God is with them and they can go in and conquer, even though they may not have the numbers? But what is that meant for us to understand about war and things? I mean, we're not supposed to go in and take away something from somebody else, so why are the Jews told to go do this?
Well, they were not allowed to go in. God says to Abraham that he's not going to give the land to the Jews until the sin of the Amori, the inhabitants, reaches a point where they don't deserve it anymore. So God expresses that it was justifiably removed from them. They sinned to such a point that they had to be exterminated. Just like the Egyptians chasing after the Jews, they had such a level of corruption that God exterminated them. And the generation of the flood as well. So the people that were in the land then also, but God was just. He said the Jews can't take it yet because they weren't worthy of being exterminated until they reach a certain point of corruption. So you see, it was clearly, the Torah tells us that it gives an answer to your very question. They had no right to existence anymore. The Jews went in, and once those people who owned the land were killed because they sinned against God. So now the land has no owner. The Jews can occupy it. And on top of that, God says he's not giving that as an inheritance. He's giving it as a place for the correct ideas. I mean, the world is really is supposed to have, it only has purpose as far as man uses it to approach the world of wisdom and to follow God. So he gives the land on the condition that you will follow the law, and if you don't, you'll be vomited out. And they were. They were exiled. And just because other people come into it afterwards, that doesn't mean that the inheritance is lost.
Are we supposed to read anything special into the land? Or is that just, it could have been any land, but this is the land that God chose for the Jews?
Yes, there's nothing specific about the soil. Maybe the topography is good. I mean, when I was in Israel, in Jerusalem, the weather was just amazing. I mean, it was in the summertime. It was completely, humid-free, beautiful blue skies. It was every day like clockwork. It was 4 o'clock as the sun started to set, And you still had a few hours of sunlight after that, but as you'd have this breeze that would just blow through Jerusalem, just cooled off everything. But even in the middle of the day, if you're under like a shady tree, it was very, very comfortable. So I'm sure that everything about it is something which serves a good, but it's not because of anything about that specific soil. We don't attribute any, you know, divinity to the soil, the rocks. So, but it could be that God definitely created the topography of Israel to have certain benefits. That could be. But again, I mean, God wants the good for every human being. And unless Israel is big enough to tolerate 6 billion people, which I think might be a little cramped, that you must say that, you know, there's rest of the, like, for example, New York. I always tell people that, they say, you know, nothing matches Israel. I say, listen, God created New York too. There's some beautiful scenery in New York. So, and the truth is, if Israel annexes, you know, according to Jewish law, different territories of the earth, it has the same status as Israel.
Rabbi, to follow up on that, I've heard people say, and I've, you know, said it years ago myself when I visited there, that there's something special about when you walk, when you're in that land and you walk in it, not like the dirt is magic or anything like that, but there's just something that people will say, gee, this is a very spiritual place. Now, that either could be that there really is some special energy, if you will, about being in the land, or it just could be sort of an emotional projection that we make when we go there because we know about the history and everything else.
Well, there's a statement of the rabbis that the air of Israel makes one wise. But how would you explain that?
Well, I probably would explain it that because you're there, you're in an atmosphere, hopefully, where people are involved in the world of ideas, and so you're going to absorb that just by being in that environment. But it's not something magical about the quality of the molecules of oxygen and so forth, but it's more about the environment.
Exactly. I mean, that coupled with all the history is something which I agree with. That's exactly how I would explain it. The environment, it leans your mind towards certain areas where, when you're in different areas, the influences can ruin you. So here, there's a benefit. When you're in an area, for example, a person spends a lot of his day in the library as opposed to, you know, in the game room, he's much more inclined to have his thoughts engaged in higher matters.
Yep.
Right, so that's exactly how I'd explain it, see?
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
I had a guy once describe to me who lived there saying that living in Israel is hard on the body but good for the soul.
Mm-hmm.
I think his interpretation, what I got from him about that in the context was making a living and doing all the things you have to do here to make a living is harder here than, say, in the United States where you previously lived, but that the environment, as we just discussed, was much more conducive to you know, one's soul.
Right. Yep, that's exactly it. But it doesn't mean that a person that lives outside of Israel is not going to be wise. That means it has an added benefit. But a person
right.
who loves wisdom, he could be living anywhere. And he is completely, he could be much more engaged in wisdom than the guy living in Israel who's not involved in wisdom. It's no panacea. It's no magic cure. I mean, again, it's free will.
Right.
But for sure, it's definitely wise to surround. I mean, that's the whole idea of tzitzis and tefillin, that when we have certain influences around us, closely bound upon us, our body, our clothing, our houses, with the mezuzah, it's based on the very idea that you're talking about, that there are certain visual cues that do affect the person. Of course, he has to know what's written inside. Just putting a black box on is useless if you have no idea what's written inside the black box.
Right.
Like Rabbi Tree explained once, that if a person does, he was quoting Rashi, saying that if a person does a mitzvah, but he doesn't understand anything about the mitzvah, so then the mitzvah is useless. That doesn't mean he is free from fulfilling the command. It means that he's not gaining anything from the command. The command always has to be something which affects a person's ideas about God. And if it doesn't reach that objective, so then it's just it's a blank action that a person's going through.
That's very interesting, because that supports and nicely explains a principle that I've understood from Rabbi Chait for many years, that with regard to Noahides, that you should only take on an additional commandment if you truly understand and see the benefit to you of doing that.
Right.
Because otherwise, I think our religious emotion sneaks in there and starts to wreak havoc with things.
Yes. He has a lot to be on guard of, but you know, as the weeks go on, we can learn more and more each week and review. And over time, it starts having an effect, and we start sensing, you know, categories of commands, which are more fundamental, which are less fundamental. And we start getting a greater picture. But it has to be a regular basis. Somebody this past week had mentioned a quote from the rabbis that says, if you abandon me for one day, I'll abandon you for 2 days. So it's the Torah personified. The Torah, so to speak, is addressing man and telling man that if you go a 24-hour period without studying me, so I'm going to abandon you for 2 days. Which means what? That if a person doesn't engage in Torah for a certain amount of time, the effects are harder to get back in. So it's as if the Torah is abandoning him as well for an additional amount of time. So it grows exponentially. That a person has to, if he distances himself from it, then his energies are going back to the emotions. So then it's harder to extricate oneself from the emotions and then get back into the world of wisdom. But if he stays with it on a daily basis and he has set time for learning, so then he's always engaged in it, he's always thinking about an idea, and it just is, it's something which is easier upon him the next time he picks up a book, because he never really left that area. Okay, he had to work for a few hours, he had to do this, he had to do that errand, but it's always on his mind, it's always in the back of his mind. I saw once a couple of weeks ago a rabbi who wrote that who's considered a person who's, they call a person, there's a phrase called the Torasso Unasso, that his Torah is his occupation. So is that a person who's studying Torah 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, in place of a guy who's working? No, he says this phrase even applies to a person who only learns even an hour a day, but he always returns to learning whenever all of his occupations are done, whenever all of his requirements and obligations are done for the day. What does he always return to after that? What does he do with his free time? If he goes right back to Torah study, that's a person whose real occupation in life is Torah, because that's really what he always wants to get back to. It doesn't matter how many hours he has to spend providing for himself and his family. But if he always is going back to Torah and wisdom when he is released from all his obligations, so that's the person who's really the highest level.
On a related subject, we did a class about 3 or 4 classes back where you referred to a shiur given by Rabbi Chait that had taken place, I think, shortly before the class, where he indicated that the perfection of a Noahide, if I recall, is to ultimately take on all the commandments.
That's right.
Right after that class, I went out to YBT.org, and I saw that shiur on Rabbi Chait's audio classes. Mm-hmm. And I said, I got to come back and listen to that. Then, when I had an opportunity, I went back a few days later, and that shiur was gone. Would you have any idea why?
No. Maybe the glitch.
I would. Maybe is. Do you know who I would email about that?
You can email Ben at YBT.org.
Okay. Okay. All right. Made myself a note.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually backed up by Gemara. I believe it's in the Avodah Zarah. It was in Sanhedrin. I got to think again. And it says that God offered the Torah to all the nations.
Right.
So you see clearly that his objective was that all the nations would have the Torah. They rejected it for one reason or the other. That is, you know, that's in consonance with what Rabbi Chait explained. There's another idea too, which was, you know, again in this week's Parsha. I don't know if we had discussed it. It was again in response to Jesse's question, but I had seen something very interesting, and that was the if you look at the historical events from the time the Jews left Egypt until they reached Sinai. So I had seen one thing that Ramban, Nachmanides, says that the temple is really to be a microcosm of Sinai, at least the cherubs and the ark. They're gold, and they shimmer just like flames are golden and shimmer. And the cherubs and the ark, so the ark contains the tablets, and on Sinai, from amidst the flames, were the tablets given. So he says it's supposed to be a continued replica of Sinai. But then I thought to myself, that's true. If the ark and the cherubim are to be a replica of the destination of Sinai, so what about the menorah? What about the curtain? What about the incense altar and the table with the showbread that are inside the tabernacle? What about the altar on the outside of the tabernacle where they sacrificed animals? What are all these? And I saw something which I didn't really do a thorough research if anybody agrees with this, but I'll just mention it because to me it's startling. And that is, if you look at the historical events, so the Jews left Egypt. And Egypt was a place of animal deification. And they had to demonstrate that animals are nothing by killing the Paschal lamb if they wanted to be redeemed. So they kill the animal and they leave animal worship behind them. As they travel in the desert, they're accompanied by a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. They also receive the manna, the bread, until they finally reach Sinai, and they give them the tablets. And again, that's on a cloudy day, and they weren't allowed to go up to the mountain. There had to be a veil between them and God. They could not ascend the mountain, like we said earlier. Now, if you look at the structure of temple, so on the outside of the temple, more removed from the Holy of Holies, you have the altar where they sacrificed animals. As you leave that behind you and you walk into the temple, you are approached with the incense altar that creates the cloud. You have the menorah, which is flames. You have the table of the showbread, again mimicking the pillar of cloud, the pillar of flames. The manna is mimicked by the table with the showbread. Then you have a curtain separating that room from the Holy of Holies, just like you had the rope that was roping off the mountain from where the Torah was given. And behind the curtain in the temple, in the tabernacle, you have the cherubim and the Ten Commandments. And that's what you had beyond the rope when Moses ascended. There was a fiery top of the mountain, just like the fiery-looking gold cherubim. So it's amazing that if this is true, and it seems to have so many indications that it is, the temple has to be a continuous replication of the historical travels of the Jews leaving Egypt and arriving at Sinai. That 50-day transition period was not something just to be for those Jews at that era, 3,300 years ago. That is something which God demands that temples should embody on a regular basis. And that means that the removal of a man from his feelings of projecting any deification on animals, let alone, you know, plant life and inanimate rocks and stone. So man has to first do that, remove himself from that, but then also recognize the cloud that's between him and God, and the light, the knowledge that he can't attain, and the fact that also God sustains us, the manna, in our goal in life towards obtaining knowledge, which is the cherubim, the cherubs on top of the ark. So it seemed to be that very event, those series of events, and those phenomena that God created, those miraculous phenomena, are to be recalled on throughout our lives when we have the structure of temple. It's quite an interesting parallel.
That is an amazing parallel.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's what I said when I saw it too. I said, this is interesting. It's like you don't normally put together events which transpire and parallel them to physical objects. Normally when you make a parallel, you say, oh, this apple looks like the same size as this orange. That's a typical parallel. You're dealing in the same realm. But then when you see this, it's pretty interesting. And it all came from that one statement of the Ramban about the ark that houses the tablets was gold, and it reflects the fire that was on Sinai from which God gave the tablets.
Wow.
Yeah,
it's interesting because sometimes in reading through those Torah portions where it goes into great detail about all the things in the tabernacle, I can't help but find it a bit tedious.
Yes.
Sort of wondering, okay, so, you know, there's nothing really here that I'm going to find. Yeah. And it goes over and over it, and yet that's an amazing idea just sort of tucked away in there.
Right. Just like the altar had to be incensed whenever they were cleaning or lighting the menorah. Small little detail, but it opens up a whole new area of knowledge.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. Very, very amazing. I mean, everything from there's details about certain vessels. You took the poles out of them when you were done carrying them and you put them into the temple. But the ark, even when it came to rest in the temple, you did not take the poles out. They had to stay there. The poles had to remain in the ark. Why? All the poles from the altars and the showbread, the table of showbread, you took the poles out there. Again, something is being indicated over there.
Can you say that again, in the first part? The poles of the ark remained, but
the poles of the...
for carrying the other things?
That's right. They were removed. Once they came to rest, they would take the poles out, which makes sense. Once you're done transporting something, you don't need the carrying poles to be inside the object anymore. Take the poles out. Put them away in storage. When you need to carry them, then put the poles back in. But that wasn't the case with the ark. Not only that, but it says when King Solomon brought the ark into the temple, when he constructed the first temple, it says that he brought them in, and the wings of the cherubs, he made an additional two figurines in the Holy of Holies. And when it's talked about those figurines, and they had wings and they were covering, so he says those wings were covering the ark and the poles. Wow, that's a that's giving another level of significance to the poles. That the wings of the those cherubs that King Solomon made, for whatever reason, he made a second set, and they were in the Holy of Holies. When he brought the ark in and he rested it, it says the wings of those cherubs that he made were covering the ark and its poles. It's like putting the poles on par with the ark itself. That seems very odd.
Yes, it does. Well, now I have to ask the answer.
Okay. Well, the way we
approach... Well, there's two questions, right?
Go ahead.
There would be that question about Solomon, and then there would be the question about why you take the poles out of all the other stuff but not the ark.
But it could be one answer.
There could be one answer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which would be more of a unified type of approach. If we can explain both cases that are dealing with the same significance to the poles, but show one significance, I think that's a safer approach.
So that maybe raises the question of what is qualitatively different about the ark versus all the other objects in the temple.
Good. And what's the other question you have to ask?
Well, why would you leave the poles in?
Even before that, there's a question you have to ask. And then let me just, you know, address Josh and Elchanan and those people that are online. You can interact as well. The questions are not just, you know, on the phone here. There's one more question that must be...
Rabbi, is this implying that the wings were not covering the poles before?
Well, the ark wasn't in the Holy of Holies until Solomon brought it in there.
But are you saying he took it upon himself over and above what he was commanded to do to make those two additional winged figurines?
I believe so, yes.
Oh. Well, I don't know if that's the question you're looking for, but that seems like an incredibly dangerous thing to do because you're adding to the commandments of Hashem.
Well, since he wasn't, there's no discussion that there was anything wrong about that, we'd have to say that he was definitely within rights to do so. Evidently, even when they built the temple, it wasn't an exact duplication of tabernacle. It was bigger, it was taller. There were windows that he put into it. There was a lot more, but it wasn't in violation. The basic elements were there. Tabernacle evidently is the minimal, but there was room for adornment, you know, in the actual final stationary temple. But Joshua, actually, he hit it on the head. He asks, what is the significance of the poles? Meaning, what is the definition of what are poles for? Let's first define the terms. That has to be defined. If we understand poles, then we have the first essential step for giving the answer.
Very good question. Is it something about, I mean, they're obviously used to carry stuff.
Right.
But does it also connect with, you weren't allowed to touch the ark. So is it some, I don't like the use of the term intermediary, but they represent somehow the process by which we connect to the knowledge of Hashem, because it's sort of what we are allowed to touch, which allows us to move that, not us, but the appropriate Jewish people.
Not only that, but I just recalled another element by the Poles, that the law was that the poles, the two ends of the poles, had to protrude a bit and push into the separating curtain so you should see them. It describes them as like looking like breasts, meaning like two mounds sticking out. I believe that's
because the ark was behind the Holy of Holies curtain.
Right, but it couldn't be that there was no... You had to see the contour of the ends of the poles, sticking, you know, protruding a bit into the curtain, into the parochas. So that was also another element.
So is that, that seems like it relates to the idea that we can't know God.
Right.
But we can see kind of the effect or obviously the creation and so forth, but the effect of what God does. So it's a very veiled reference, if you will.
All right,
in other
that's
words,
good.
You see a little bit, but just the general shape and...
An indication.
Yeah.
Right.
There is
something there, but you can't see it.
Right, and you don't see, I find it interesting, you don't see, it's not like you push the ark itself up against the curtain.
Right.
All you pushed was the poles, which implies an additional degree of removal of us from the ability to see the Creator himself.
Okay. Now let's get back to what poles are. And the poles have to have the equal definition, whether it's the poles for the showbread table or for the altars. A pole is a pole. So what is the pole? Like you said, they used to carry it. But they took the poles out when the other objects came to rest. Not so by the ark.
So that seems to imply that the poles of the ark had an additional function over and above simply carrying the vessel.
Yes.
As opposed to the other vessels where we could say the purpose of the pole was to carry it.
Okay.
And maybe it refers to man's connection with the Almighty, which is separate from the Almighty himself. Yeah, not clear.
Rabbi, could it be that poles help make things easier to carry? It's like a leverage thing. And the poles that are housing the Torah help... could it be like a person that carries that with them, then it helps give you the answers to life or make life easier? In the sense of providing the wisdom, sort of the blueprint for life?
To me, that, I think we're going further than what we really have to say. See, if we just stick to what the poles do, they're for transport. And the other vessels, clearly, you take the poles out, that means that the transport is done. That means it's reached its destination.
No.
But you don't take the poles out of the ark, because that would give the indication that the temple is a destination for the ark. Ah, the ark finally came to the temple, and now we can take the poles out. That would give the inverse idea, which is false. It's not that the temple is complete once you have the ark. The ark has to be the focus, because that holds the Torah. The temple is subordinate to the ark, just to give you a location. It's just walling off a location, but it's really not a destination. And also, I believe that's why there's no roof to the temple. They just had some curtains, and that was merely protective in terms of the vessels, so that the elements shouldn't affect them. But there was no structural roof to the temple, just some animal skins and some linens.
On the temple or the tabernacle?
The tabernacle, excuse me. The tabernacle.
Oh, okay.
So, in order to indicate that the focus is really the Ark, the Torah, and not the temple, we don't take the poles out, meaning the Ark didn't come to a final destination. It's not that now the Ark finds a higher purpose when it's in temple. That's not true. The Ark itself has the Torah. The Torah itself is the highest purpose. So in order to indicate that, we don't take the poles out. It didn't find any greater perfection when it was in this location or in another location. Simply, it has to be some locations. Some location. Okay, and Joshua is mentioning that it should be in a state of mobility at all times. I hear that. Elchanan wants to say that the poles seem fragile. But I think this definition we're giving, it hits a little more in the head, that you don't state that the Ark now came to a final destination, that it reached a higher objective when it's in temple. Because that would now say the temple itself has an added benefit to the Ark, which is not true. So that's what people think in terms of like a president. He's got to live in the White House. Until he lives in the White House, he's really not president. Ah, but when he's in the president, you know, he's in the presidential palace, that adds something. Because that is a fabricated thing. The fact that a person lives in the great palace, people think that that now adds to the greatness of the person. But that's not true. The true greatness of the person could be, he could be living in a cave and he's a greater person than a person who lives in a palace. But our world functions with people's false ideas about what they assume greatness is. So until the president has a White House, that's it, you know. There has to be a building which testifies to the greatness of the person. But that's a false idea. But that's the way the world works. And you can't stop them. However, Torah works based on truth. Therefore, a building doesn't add anything. It's the ideas. It's the written word. That's really the most important thing. So don't take the poles out. Don't give the impression that the Ark finds a higher benefit in this building. No. That would skew a person's view of what the focal point must be in life. And the focus must be the ideas, the Seres HaDibros, the Ten Commands on those sapphire tablets. So we do not take the poles out. Everything else, though, is subordinate to the Ark. That's why you take the poles out of the table with the showbread and the altars, because they are there to point towards the Ark, to point towards what the Ark contains, God's wisdom. So they do find a higher objective when they are in connection with the Ark in temple. So you take the poles out of those objects. All right, you see the idea. Elchanan, Joshua, clear? Cal, you got it?
Yes.
And that again is what King Solomon, it says over there that when he brought the Ark in, that the statues of the cherubim that he made covered the Ark and the poles, because the poles are significant in terms of pointing at what the essence of the Ark is. So that's why in the discussion about King Solomon's days when he built the temple and he brought the Ark in, so equal level of gravity is given to the poles, because the poles point to the very purpose of Ark. Right? A very simple point the Torah tells you, but then you have to dig into it. Again, to Daniel's point that you started out with.
Can I ask one final question on that?
Yes.
I'm just slightly intrigued by their, apparently, you mentioned it in the Talmud, that they say the poles were supposed to stick to the curtain like two breasts. And I'm wondering if they use that terminology because of the primary purpose of a breast is nurturing, and if that sort of points to the nurturing nature of the ideas of the Torah and being involved in that. Or am I reading too much into that?
I don't know. Truth is, it'd really be good to find the source. Let me see if I can locate the source on that. Give me 1 second, all right?
Okay.
I don't know where it is offhand. I'll have to see if I can locate it. I'm not sure if it was Rashi. But let me see if I can try and get back to you on that.
Okay.
Let me see. Maybe it's in the another moment here. One sec. Actually, in the parsha, it talks about that. Let's go back to Truma.
Your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
You don't see. Could be in a later point. All right, let me do some research on it. I don't see it here in Yuma where it talks about it. I'll try to research it further. All right?
Okay.
All right, so we're on for next week?
We are on for next week.
Okay, very good.
Thank you, Rabbi. Just a wonderfully rich class.
Okay, my pleasure. Now, let me see here. Joshua has a last comment here. If the temple is for the ark, not the ark of temple, how in the past has the temple existed without the ark in it? All right. All right, if you have any reference on that, Josh, why don't you send an email on the source. We'll try to look that up for next week. Okay, good question, though. All right, so I'll wrap it up for today. We'll put the class online shortly, so if you missed any part of it, you can hear it in its entirety. And we'll resume next week, 11:15 Eastern Time.
Sounds right? Great, Rabbi. You have a great weekend. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, everybody.
Take care.
Okay, be well.
Bye-bye.
Okay, so we'll resume next week. A good week to everybody. And any questions, feel free to send in. Okay, you're welcome, Josh, Elchanan, JHS, I guess Patera, And we'll see you all next week if you can make it. Take care.